Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Blog Talk Radio. This is Southern Sense, and I'm your hostess with the mostest, Annie, the radio chick, along with my frozen north friend, Cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Well put. It is cold and it is frozen. So good afternoon, everybody. Glad to be here on this wonderful Tuesday. It is February 5th.
Absolutely.
And always looking forward to a fun night of Southern Sense. I should say.
We've got an exciting guest. His name is Mike Cutler, and he spent 3 decades as an INS, or as you know, an ICE agent, and he's testified before presidential committees and Congress in reference to illegal immigration. He's going to be an absolutely awesome guest, and what he will tell you about illegal immigration will curl your hair. But I will warn you, he is not a conservative. He is not even a Republican. He is a longtime Democrat. And his views on immigration, you will find absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing, Mike. Some of the stories he tells us. Absolutely.
Just the stories. Whenever you get somebody in-depth, as we did even in our last show, who just, for a career, made a career of doing something, perfecting it, there's so much that the layperson just doesn't know or see. So it's always quite brings you to life is what it does. It wakes you up, opens your eyes.
Yeah, and that's what I hope to do. And, you know, people say, well, you're a conservative show, you only have conservatives on. Well, Mike Cutler is not a conservative. And you're going to see how America truly feels about this. You know, you've got a few people hijacking an issue, but when you let the real people out there talk, you'd be amazed on what you're going to learn. Absolutely. All right. I want to remind everyone that we do have a new website. It's southernsense.webs.com, and we got a raffle going on so that someone who enters the raffle can win Todd Allen Herndon's video DVD autographed of My Name is America. It's a great DVD video. I played it several times. I can't tell you how many times I played it. But this has not been played, but it has been autographed by him. So you've got a virgin copy. Don't worry about that.
Virgin copy.
Yeah. With his teeth mark on it from where he had to rip the cover off so he could autograph it. All right. I picked up something really cool, Mike. I got that neat desk. You see that thing on TV that it files everything on your computer, all your paperwork for you?
The what? You're kind of breaking up, so can you repeat that?
Oh, it's between blog and Skype, I'm sorry. But
yeah.
That desk advertised on TV, you get in your paper and your bills and everything to your computer.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, you remember the picture I sent you of my desk? Well,
yeah.
I think in about 3 months, you're going to see my desk completely empty.
So you're going to scan it all into the, into that, and have it all into the memory bank?
Yeah, it's fast. It's really sweet. Well, anyway, after that bad commercial, I want to remind everyone we start off each show with dedication with fallen hero. And today's dedication is for the Air Force. So, Mike, if you pull up the Air Force song, and this is going out to Master Sergeant Tara R. Brown, who was killed in action on April 27th of 2011. This is from Marine Corps Base, Quantico, Virginia. Hundreds of military and civilian mourners packed Chapel 1 at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland on May 9th, 2001, to attend a memorial service honoring the latest Air Force Office of Special Investigations fallen hero. Master Sergeant Tara R. Brown, 33, of New York, died April 27th of 2011 of wounds sustained when an Afghan gunman, who also killed seven other airmen as well as an American civil contractor, went on a shooting spree in the Afghan Air Force compound near Kabul, Afghanistan. When I think of the word service as it pertains to Tara, three words come to mind, which accurately depict the type of person that she truly was. Dedication, honor, and commitment. Brigadier General Kevin Jacobson of the 8th OSI commander said during his eulogy, Abraham Lincoln once said that for evil to prevail, all it takes is a few good souls to remain silent. Tara wasn't silent. She chose to serve. She chose to stand tall and be counted. She pledged unwavering support and committed herself to a life of service, no matter the time, location, or circumstance, and no matter the sacrifice. Tara understood the risk and the love of her country outweighed any fear of personal harm, the general added. In his closing comments, General Jacob said that Tara offered herself on the altar of patriotism for the nation she loved. Only those who have served in times of war can know the true meaning of this kind of commitment and sacrifice, he said. Sergeant Brown's body and the bodies of the seven other airmen killed with her were returned from Afghanistan to Dover Air Force Base. Besides family members, also in attendance for the dignified transfer at Dover, were Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, Air Force Chief of Staff, General Norton Schwartz, and Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, James Roy. Sergeant Brown's Air Force career began in June of 1995 when she enlisted into the Delayed Entry Program after graduating from Deltona High School in Deltona, Florida. She reported to basic training at Flatland Air Force Base in Texas in February of 96. Upon completion of basic training and technical training at Kessler Air Force Base, Mississippi, she was assigned to Kaneda Air Force Base in Japan, where she began working in the administrative career field. Numerous overseas assignments followed, along with several deployments. Sergeant Brown was assigned to headquarters AFOSI at Andrews Air Force Base in November of 2006. She served in the Director of Operations and in the Global Watch before being assigned to her most recent position as the non-commissioned officer in charge, client support technician in the personnel division. people assigned to AFOSI, she was deployed to Eskin Village, Saudi Arabia, and to Kandahar Air Force Field in Afghanistan. In July of 2001, Sergeant Brown deployed to Kabul as a communication squadron advisor for NATO Air Training Command Afghanistan. In this role, she trained Afghan Air Force technicians on the basic fundamentals of desktop computers and computer networking. Sergeant Brown and three siblings grew up on Long Island, New York, before moving to Deltona, Florida in the mid-90s. They were raised by their father, who later remarried and had another son. She sang in the church choir and aspired to become a pediatric nurse. But 3 weeks before graduation from Deltona High School in 95, Sergeant Brown told her father she was going into the Air Force. She worked her way up the ranks, becoming a master sergeant. The latest deployment was on what her father, Jim Brown, called history-making mission. As a career airman, Sergeant Brown earned the Purple Heart, Meritorious Service Medal, and the Joint Service Commendation Medal. Her career awards included the 99 NATO AWACS-E-3A Component Training Wing Airman of the Year, 2000 NATO AWACS-E-3A Component Training Wing Airman Information Manager of the Year, the 2000 NATO Component Training Wing Airman of the Year, the 2009 Headquarters Air Force of Special Investigations Non-Commissioner Officer of the Year, and the 2009 Communications and Information Non-Commissioned Officer of the Year. In December 2010, Sergeant Brown, full-time friend, Army Sergeant Ernest Brown, married at a New England courthouse. They celebrated their marriage with a party at their Maryland home. The couple did not have children. Besides her father and husband, Sergeant Brown is survived by her mother, Gladys Vereen of New York, brothers Jim Jacobs of Florida, Dominic Jacobs of New York, Michael Jacobs of Florida, Christopher Batiste of Florida, and his sister, Laganda Jacobs of Maryland. And I will make a notation here that Master Sergeant Jacobs was assigned to a desk duty, but even that did not prevent her from being in harm's way in Afghanistan. So to her and to all our heroes who are serving and have served, we dedicate this song to them, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Harrington.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name, I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up. Taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour.
'cause my name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger and I'll rise up.
I want to see hands up in the air. Everyone in the chat room listening, and tell me how many people have to mute their mics. I end up singing along with that song.
Well, you have a co-host who's like that.
Oh, yes. And I want to remind everyone, we have this autographed video DVD of Todd Allen Harrington singing the song. It's up as a raffle on our website, southernsense.web.com. Click on it and enter the raffle to win his autographed DVD. And I have it sitting here personally from his hands. So, Mike, let's bring on our guest. We've got a fantastic guest. He's a former INS, as you know, an ICE agent for 3 decades. He's testified before Congress and presidential committees on illegal immigration. Welcome aboard, Mike Cutler.
Thank you so much for having me, Ann. Great to have met you in South Carolina at the Tea Party Convention, as we did. And certainly, I appreciate the work you did as a New York City police officer and now, of course, as the host of this terrific radio program.
Yeah, and I have to apologize. Blog Talk Radio is reformatting their website, so sometimes people are going to have a hard time hearing us. It's a glitch with Blog Talk. I really can't control it.
They're reformatting everything. Hey, to our guests, don't thank her too much for being a cop. I'm sure there's a lot of people got tickets to.
Well, you know, what's kind of ironic, and, you know, we both had the contact one way or the other with a police officer by the name of Robert Machete. And, in fact, that was a starting point. Bob Machete was a police officer who was killed by an alien I had physically deported. He came back, and, in fact, I testified at the murder trial. Police work, needless to say, law enforcement is a dangerous profession. I don't think it's significantly different from the military. Same goals, except as some of my friends had pointed out, different battlefield. But it is certainly a service to America and to the community, and it's something that we should all revere and respect. How's that, Ann?
That sounds great. I'm going to address this to my co-host. Mike, I need to take over for a split second because I'm going to try to re-Skype in. I'm getting people telling me in the chat room they can't hear me at all.
Alrighty.
So if you just bear with me while I try to redo this.
I think Mike and Mike can have it covered while you do your reboot. Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, like where you were born and growing up and how you ended up actually working for the feds?
Well, I'm a New Yorker. I even went to Brooklyn College. You don't get to be more Brooklyn than that. I'm still a New Yorker. Started working for the old INS a long time ago, October 1971. I started out as an immigration inspector at Kennedy Airport. I did that job for about 4 years. For one of those 4 years, I was assigned to the unit that adjudicated the application for residency based on marriage. You know, we've all seen the movies, the interviews that get conducted, that sort of thing. I did it for a year. In fact, it was kind of funny. I was one of a couple of examiners who tripped upon an attorney who was arranging marriages. If you could imagine this, between Chinese seamen who had jumped ship and young ladies who were involved with prostitution in the New York area. The lawyer wound up getting convicted in federal court. It was my first trial where I testified. And then in 1975, I became what was then called a criminal investigator. Now it's known as a special agent. I rotated through all the divisions within the investigations branch. In 1988, I was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration in New York. I was the first INS agent to be given that assignment. And then in 1991, I was promoted to the position of senior special agent and assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. 1976, I tripped over a PLO plot, the terrorist plot to blow up an Israeli oil refinery. We prevented the attack. So with that background in mind, in 1997, May of 97, I was called upon to do my first congressional hearing before the House Immigration Subcommittee on the issue of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud. And the incentive for that hearing were the two terrorist attacks that had been committed inside the United States in 1993. Kind of remarkable. We won the Second World War in 44 months. We got attacked first at the CIA by an individual by the name of Amir Khanzi, a Pakistani national who lied on his applications for political asylum. And then a month later at the first Trade Center attack where six people died, thousands perhaps, if not hundreds, injured. The towers almost came down. And so it took us over 4 years to hold that hearing after the attack, and then I went on and testified to numerous hearings after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And I work when the opportunities are there and when I agree with the position of the attorneys as an expert witness on issues that involve immigration. So that's the short version that I've done. I don't know how many media appearances. In fact, I was on Neil Cavuto's program last night talking about this lunacy of comprehensive reform. And have Janet Napolitano, under the Senate bill, if you folks don't know this, it's startling. The head of Homeland Security, or as I call it, Homeland Surrender, would be the arbiter who would then certify that the border is secure so we could go ahead and give what the administration claims is $11 million, and I'm willing to bet would be closer to $30 million, illegal aliens, lawful status in our country, even though there's no way of knowing who they are or why they're here. How wacky is that, Mike?
Quick question. You had mentioned an attack from the CIA. Now, I'm aware of the World Trade Center of 93. What was the CIA attack?
Okay, there was a guy by the name of Amir Khanzi, a Pakistani national, who claimed political asylum. And, you know, I'm very sensitive to the issue of political asylum. I happen to be Jewish. I was named for my grandmother who perished in the Holocaust. She was slaughtered in the Holocaust. And, in fact, as a B'nai B'rith president back at Brooklyn College and back when I was in high school, I participated in demonstrations in Washington to convince then-President Lyndon Johnson to let the religious minorities leave the Soviet Union, to work with the Soviet government to allow these folks to go to whatever country would have them so they could experience religious freedom. And as an inspector, I was delighted to admit refugees into the United States. But where things now stand, that issue of political asylum, while so many decent people do avail themselves of the opportunity, and I don't begrudge them, it has become a tactic that the terrorists have used to enter the United States and embed themselves. So this guy, Khanzi, gets political asylum and repays our generosity on a cold morning in January in Virginia, right outside CIA headquarters, stood there with an AK-47 and opened fire on the cars being driven in by CIA officers. Pardon me, when the dust settled, he had killed two CIA officers and wounded three others. And he did something that so many international terrorists and transnational criminals are able to do. He escaped from the United States by going through that trap door, so to speak, and went back to Pakistan. But in his case, given the nature of the crime that he committed, our guys hunted him down, brought him back here, put him on trial. He was found guilty, subsequently executed. But nevertheless, the people that he killed obviously remained dead. The people that were injured remained injured. And this is an amazing situation that we see the bad guys exploiting our kindness and seeing in our kindness and generosity weakness. Mm-hmm. Astonishing,
yeah,
isn't it?
It certainly is. Another quick question. We're going to have Annie back in a minute.
Sure.
So you had worked, obviously, through many presidents, through many elections. In fact, is there any particular administration that you would say really, really helped make your job much easier and basically the way it should be, the way our founders originally had it? Because as we see, there's just so damn much, it's just ballooned now into just so much bureaucracy and bullshit.
It's not bureaucracy. By the way, let me give out a couple of websites so that if folks want to keep track of what I've been doing and have an opportunity to read some of the stuff I've written and see some of the videos I've done. There's three websites I'd love everybody to visit. First and foremost, michaelcutler.net. That's one word. My last name is C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. I have another website, talkborder.com. That's one word, T-A-L-K-B-O-R-D-E-R, talkborder.com. I actually have videos on that one. And, in fact, for example, I did an interview with Congressman Lou Barletta. Lou Barletta was the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania. He was the first mayor in the United States to enact ordinances to penalize those folks who would intentionally hire illegal aliens or provide them with housing. Immediately, he got sued by the ACLU. It's crazy. His incentive for doing it wasn't xenophobia, as we keep hearing in the media by some of these wackaloons. It was actually the fact that he suddenly found that there were members of MS-13 and other violent gangs who had set up shop in his community, killing people, selling drugs to children, committing violent crimes, and he figured that if they could get rid of the illegal aliens, and these gang members all were illegal aliens, that this would help community safety. I was the final witness at his trial. He's now a member of the House Homeland Security Committee, and he's one of my heroes. He's one of the few people on Capitol Hill who I hold in super high esteem. There's a couple of other real good guys, Congressman Steve King from Iowa, Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama, Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa. There are some guys on that and gals in Congress who try to do the right thing, but they are the rarity. As for your question, I guess we were at the high point from my perspective when I was hired on and Richard Nixon was the president, and after that it was the plunge into the abyss. It was Jimmy Carter who followed Nixon, obviously, and he mandated that we no longer use the term illegal alien. He said we had to call them undocumented workers and then undocumented immigrants, which is nonsense. The term alien, you know, is not an insult or a pejorative. It simply means any person who's not a citizen or national of the United States. And if you could find an insult there, I'd love to know what it is. And then, of course, we had Ronald Reagan, who gave us the first amnesty. We were told it was going to be a one-shot deal. We were told that it would involve about 1 million to 1.5 million illegal aliens. And point of fact, we wound up with nearly 4 million, which is why when they say 11 million now, I'm willing to bet that we're looking at over 30 million. We had Bill Clinton, who, I mean, goodness, we had those two terrorist attacks in 93. And by the way, I'm a registered Democrat, so that, you know, I don't want anyone to think this is about being conservative or liberal. It's about being American. Bill Clinton refused to learn the lessons that those two terrorist attacks of 93 that were done on his watch in our country. Then, in fact, he implemented a program called Citizenship USA, where they rushed well over 1 million applications for citizenship through the bureaucratic machinery. It turned out that thousands of the aliens who were given citizenship should have been deported. Not my finding. That was the findings of the General Accountability Office and the Inspector General. And then, of course, we have George W. Bush, who, after our country was attacked, had Border Patrol agents prosecuted for doing their job and sent Border Patrol agents, including the elite BORTAC teams, to secure the Iraqi border, but left our border wide open and insisted on basically entering into more NAFTA agreements, as did the Clinton administration. And now, of course, we come to where we are. An absolute disaster. And you know, I got to tell you, Mike, what most people don't get, and they really need to get, is that our immigration laws are not minor. It's not a single issue. You know, when they do these surveys, they say to the public, what do you consider the most important issue? Unemployment, the economy, national security. And somewhere in there they put down the word immigration, and immigration winds up with, like, you know, 8% of the people saying immigration. In point of fact, immigration goes to the heart of each and every one of those other challenges. I want you folks to think about something. And I could back this up very easily by telling you that if you look at the categories of aliens we're supposed to keep out of the United States, you realize the clear nexus between immigration, our borders, and national security. The list of people who are supposed to be kept out, aliens, can be found in Title 8 of the United States Code, Section 1182. I'm not going to talk about law today. I don't want to bore anybody, but I just want you to know that I'm not pulling this out of my left ear. 1182 of Title 8 enumerates the categories, and it starts with aliens who have dangerous communicable diseases. With all the breast-beating by the open borders crowd that I call the immigration anarchists, oh, my God, they closed Ellis Island. Ellis Island was a quarantine station run by immigration in conjunction with public health. So the first category of aliens to be excludable are aliens who have a dangerous communicable disease. Incredibly, AIDS has been taken off that list, by the way. Again, you got to love the politics of immigration. The second category, aliens who suffer mental illness and are violent or sex offenders. Then we get to the criminal aliens, the gang members, the human rights violators, the war criminals, the terrorists, the spies, the people who have been previously deported and reentered illegally. And then you get to the aliens who would take the work Americans would do if only they could get the job. So realize this is not inconsequential. In a manner of speaking, in fact, our borders are secured externally by the U.S. military. Their mission is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible. It's up to DHS to secure those borders from within the interior of the United States. And then we hear this mythology, you know, the borders exist in four states. You know, we've all heard it. I'm sure you've heard it, Mike. California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. They blithely leave out the northern border that separates the U.S. from Canada. They leave out the fact that we have 95,000 miles of coastline, and they leave out the fact that we have international airports in virtually every state. And right now there are between 5 and 10 million illegal aliens in our country who did not run our borders but entered through ports of entry and then violated the terms of their admission. And in fact, the 19 terrorists who so savagely attacked us on 9/11 all entered through international airports. So every state is a border state, even though the politicians would love for us to not pay attention to that, because the goal is to bring in as many foreign nationals as possible, whether they're here legally or illegally, so that the people that can profit off of this trade in labor can make out literally and figuratively like bandits. And, I mean, look what happened in California. They're bankrupt. And by the way, I should probably also mention that I'm a senior fellow with a group known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. I've been involved with that group for a bunch of years. They're a good bunch. They're located, as they like to remind me when I'm freezing my hiney off in New York, they're located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. A great bunch of folks. Pleasure to work with them out there. And through the miracle of computers and when necessary airplanes, we work well together. But California's gone bankrupt in part because they have the most liberal interpretation of immigration law. Sanctuary cities endanger community safety and national security. And yet the federal government never prosecutes a state that declares itself a sanctuary or a city, but sues states like Arizona that dare to enact immigration laws that parallel the federal statutes. In fact, I worked with a law firm that was retained by Governor Jan Brewer to defend her and her state against the Justice Department lawsuit that was launched when they enacted SB 1070, which really was a parallel set of statutes that very closely followed federal immigration law. So we're dealing with such a huge disconnect so that people that can make profit off of the exploitation of foreign workers get to do just that. And it starts with the banks, because when they move the money, and America is bleeding tens of billions of dollars in remittances every year, the bank gets a piece of that money. It's the immigration lawyers who want to have a limitless supply of clients. You've heard of ambulance chases? These are coyote chases, smuggler chases, okay? And by the way, it's not just illegal aliens. It's the way we allow people in with the high-tech visas who are supplanting Americans who have all the requisite skills and training and education, but they would expect a decent wage. So when you bring in people from third world countries, they will do a job that should command over $100,000 a year for $40,000 a year. so we're destroying the middle class and incentives for American kids to go to college.
Mike, you have gone over a huge gamut. I finally got myself back
there
in.
There you go. Now I can hear you crystal clear. Thank God.
Well, that's because I'm using a landline. I just had a... it's unbelievable.
You mean the way normal people do this, Mike, I'm like wetting my pants here with what you're saying, Mike. It's like, oh, my God. It's almost, Annie, it's almost like we have a spy reporting for duty. So help me out with something here.
Sure.
Surely, Mike, you're not implying that people like the wonderful George W. Bush and other wonderful presidents would allow basically sweatshop illegals to come in here and crush our economy of people like me and you and Annie. I mean, because that's just not America wouldn't do anything like that.
Well, let me tell you, in all too many cases, you know, I like to make the analogy, unfortunately, of the two oldest professions, politicians and hookers, and they both share the similarity of being willing to take unbelievable positions for the right price. What do you think of that statement?
That's exactly it. I mean, obviously, you
does that
have,
work?
Mike, something I had heard this, you might have. If you know anything about this or if you've seen this before, let me know. And that
sure.
is my brother, who for years was he's a chiropractor in California, and obviously.
And that's what happens when you take those unbelievable positions. You have to go see the chiropractor.
he had said when their season is complete that where years ago they used to get on a bus and head home for their season. He said, now they just go to where you are and turn themselves in. And then that way they get deported on us. And then, of course,
well, they used to. We're not deporting anybody, though. You know, I got to tell you a funny story. One of the biggest adversaries we had to Interior Enforcement was the Border Patrol, because we were competing with each other for resources, money, priorities, and so forth within the old INS. And we used to get the Border Patrol reject cars. After they'd beat them up for 130,000 miles, we would get them, and the wheels were kind of wobbling, and, you know, the windows didn't work. And you'd be sitting at a red light in a car that was painted green and white, and the folks in New York City, and believe it or not, we probably have a million illegal aliens from Latin America in New York, plus, you have the Asian community. You know, by the way, immigration isn't about Mexico. I mean, yes, we do get more illegal aliens from Mexico than from any other country, and that's a function of geography. Somebody once very astutely noted that 2,000-plus-mile border that separates Mexico from the United States is the only place on the planet where the first world collides with the third world. But we do have a significant Mexican population in New York. And it was startling when I was a brand-new agent. I was sitting at a red light with a senior partner, and all of a sudden, a bunch of illegal Mexicans tried to pile into the back seat, and it was November. And my senior partner looked at me and said, they want to go home for Christmas. True story. This is actually a true story, folks. So, but it's changed quite a bit since then. And we didn't have the level of problem that we have now. What really started to exacerbate the problem, well, there's a few. But let's start with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. We didn't do it, but in our name, our government, because of campaign contributions, go back to what I said about hookers, we drove Mexican farmers into bankruptcy because they could not compete with ADM and the other American agricultural giant conglomerates. When they lost their homes to the unfair competition posed by these North American conglomerates, they had nowhere to go but north. And that was when we had this massive influx of illegal aliens into the United States. And I remember when the debate was raging about NAFTA, there was a CBS radio reporter who did a commentary and said, NAFTA, we don't have to. And I thought, boy, that's a pretty clever slogan. And he was right. And it was the politicians from both sides of the aisle that, if you remember, they dragged out all the still-breathing presidents for a news conference to tout this wonderfulness from both sides of the aisle, free trade. Well, there's no such thing as free lunch. There's no such thing as free trade. The Mexican farmers paid, American workers paid, and ultimately the American middle class paid, and we keep on paying. But again, I want to emphasize it's not just about Mexico. And it's not just about farm workers. It's not just about menial jobs either. By the way, you look at the day laborers who take the jobs that Americans won't do. That's nonsense. My dad was a construction worker. He was a plumber. And it is so insulting when a politician stands up and talks sanctimoniously about the work an American won't do. That politician should find out what it's like to have a real job by losing his next election. There's an amazing guy by the name of Homer Hickam. I don't know if you saw the film October Sky. If you haven't seen it, you need to. If you have children at home, they need to see the movie. They need to read the book Rocket Boys. My heroes when I was growing up, I always thought sports was kind of silly. I really did. My heroes, other than my dad, were the astronauts and test pilots. I got letters from Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom, and as an agent, I had the privilege of meeting a number of our astronauts. And Homer Hickam is a little older than I am. He grew up in Colwood, which was a West Virginia coal mining town. His dad was a coal miner. And when Sputnik was launched, he was in high school, and I remember I was, I think, in fifth grade when Sputnik was launched. And it fired him up so much that ultimately he started building rockets. And at the end of the movie, you find out that he became literally a rocket scientist for NASA. And his buddies all did well because rather than emphasizing football scholarships, which had been the only way out of Colwood up until then, he got a scholarship based on his science fair project. And, you know, he delivered the eulogy at the Sago mine tragedy about a half dozen years ago when that terrible mine disaster occurred. I think 14 miners perished, if I remember the number correctly. And he delivered the eulogy, and he said something that choked me up. He said, "There's no water holier than the sweat off a man's brow." And I want you to contrast that reverence for hardworking blue-collar Americans who built this country and contrast it with the politicians who disdainfully look down their noses at Americans who get dirt under their fingernails. I am not at all convinced that three-card Monty is a product, yet that's what our bankers would convince us is a product these days. America used to build stuff. That's how we became the powerhouse of the world. That's how we won the Second World War. That's how we went to the moon. What in the world do we build today besides nonsense and excuses for our failures?
All right, Mike, we got a caller coming in. Let me bring this individual in on the line.
That was
live.
Beautifully put, by the way, Mike. Beautiful.
All right.
That was just
area code 602, you're
you,
on the air live.
Oh, Michael, you Democrat. It's Goldie the Republican.
Hey, we're both Americans, pal.
God bless you. Hey, it's good to talk to you. I've been
Thank
dying
you.
To break free and hear you on the radio. Thank you for all the work you're doing on the immigration. Mike and I, for your host there, Mike and I have broken a lot of bread and spent a lot of time on this issue. Me in the desert and Michael in the courts.
I have to add in, I was trying to do it on the streets of New York as a cop. As a matter of fact, Mike Cutler knows that I was friends with Bob Machado, the office that he was talking about earlier. I went to the police academy with him. And he was a member of our Columbia Association where I was a board officer. I sat down with his dad after Bob was killed, and I'm telling you, there's nothing worse when you lose someone like that in such a manner.
You know, I interviewed his brother, by the way, for my website, talkborder.com. His brother, in fact, became a New York City cop. He's now
retired. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, the gentleman on the phone right now, I don't know if you know this, but he had been the candidate for governor of Arizona, and he's Barry Goldwater's nephew, and it's Bob Goldwater. And Bob is a good friend, and it's always delightful getting together with him in Arizona. We have this tendency of closing restaurants. We wind up there at 3 in the morning, and we look around and realize there's nobody else there.
You know, before I get to my questions, I watch a lot of Barry Goldwater YouTube. My mentor told me if I want to learn a good speaking ability that can grasp a crowd, and I do that now, and I kind of a lot of the things I say are from Barry Goldwater and before, because even if I repeat what he says, an awful lot of people wouldn't remember it because they're not around. Now, Mike, a quick question, then we'll let Goldie follow up on this.
Sure.
What the hell is going on? Why are we not telling our agents, secure the borders, enforce the laws? I mean, it's almost as if the very people in office are fighting are absolutely not only disobeying our Constitution, because last time I checked, it was a duty of the president to protect the states from invasion. But, I mean, it's almost as if, you commented earlier, we're prosecuting those who are catching them.
That's right. We are. Because, again, understand what is happening. There is a mythology, okay, that we're enforcing the law. Napolitano Nappi comes out there and says, well, our borders have never been more secure. And every time she says that, I want to send a plastic surgeon her way that does rhinoplasty. I mean, look.
No, Michael, she's telling you the truth. The borders today are more secure. You can't get a white person next to, excuse me, I don't mean to be racist, you can't get a citizen next to the border if you paid them. So it's very secure. It's very secure for us not to get there. It's dangerous down there.
Well, and you know, what's so remarkable, I'm in a couple of documentaries that are coming out. One is They Come to America. I'm in that one. They just filmed me for the sequel. And it was remarkable because when Dennis Lynch went down there, and there's a group of folks that did Freedom Under Fire 2, done by my friend Mark Hager and his crew down in North Carolina.
Sure.
So, you know, but when he went down to the border, when Dennis Lynch went to the border to film, he was actually stopped by Border Patrol agents in an open area, and they said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm filming. What are you filming?
Yeah.
Now, I watched that several times. I re-ran it. And I have to tell you, I was freaking out. I felt like I was in Russia. You know, when I was an inspector, we didn't want people filming us in the inspections booth at the airport because there were procedures we were following and so forth. That makes sense. You're out in an open field near the border, and these Border Patrol agents came up and said, well, I'm not sure if we're going to allow you to film here.
Well,
now, I want
correct.
You to think about what we're talking about. We're not talking about a military installation. And by the way, we have how many illegal aliens running through Fort Huachuca, which is a major intelligence operation, and these folks just randomly parade themselves right through those bases like nothing is going on. But you go out there with that camera, and all of a sudden the Border Patrol agents became very concerned because I think what the problem is that reality would set in that there is absolutely no security. This is why I called DHS, the Department of Homeland Surrender. I made that point yesterday when I was on Neil Cavuto's program. But here's the thing to understand. We're being told by the President of the United States, and I made this point in you know, I think you saw this, Ann, when I spoke.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at what's going on now with the Dreamers, okay, the president called it prosecutorial discretion. I wrote a commentary for Fox News Latino. I said it was prosecutorial deception. The president does not have the right to give lawful status to people who are here in violation of law. That takes literally an act of Congress. And what I believe he is doing is unconstitutional. No, I'm not a lawyer. But I certainly have enough experience enforcing laws to tell you that this flies in the face of the intent of the law, the letter of the law. It's bizarre. There are agents now who were just told by an appeals court that they do have standing because they're so angry because they understand the significance of the immigration laws. They are now suing the administration over the administration's outrageous conduct. They are giving thousands upon thousands, and ultimately it could be millions of aliens, lawful status, official identity documents, without even conducting a face-to-face interview.
Yeah, Mike, I want to add in there that they're not even requiring proof that they do fall into the DREAM Act category or not. They're just simply taking them at their word.
At face value, yeah. But yes, even if they're providing phony documents, nobody investigates it. Nobody prosecutes it. And I want you to know, I was with Mike Chertoff at Chapman Law School in California. And we were coming back from dinner at the Nixon Library, heading to our hotel, and Mike was trying to convince me in the back of the limo, along with Asa Hutchinson, that immigration had nothing to do with 9/11. I kid you not. And I offered to get him a copy of the 9/11 Commission report. And Asa Hutchinson attempted to distract the conversation, and he actually turned to Mike Chertoff. I want you to picture the scene in the limo. There were two other gentlemen with us. One guy had been the head of intelligence, DEA, worldwide, and I knew of him. He knew of me because I had been assigned to DEA Intel when he was in Washington. So he was in the limo along with a former U.S. attorney. And they were just kind of watching this train wreck of an argument that we were having that went on for 45 minutes. And when I mentioned immigration and the border and all this other business, and it was very funny because, to back up a bit, a young lady escorting me to the car, a couple of young ladies escorted me to this, it looked like a pimpmobile, a big white stretch limo with neon lights. You had to see this
all right,
thing.
Why are women always escorting you to the, never mind.
You dog.
Goldie, you got to be named Mike to understand, but go ahead.
I just have fun with them.
But she asked me about the border fence, and 60 Minutes had just done a wonderful story about the border fence, about how screwed up it was. When I was on Lou Dobbs, and I'd been on Lou's program many times when he was at CNN, he said, what do you think of the virtual fence? And I said, Lou, it'll do what it's designed to do, cost tons of money and stop virtually nobody.
That's
right. And that was exactly what had happened. It stopped nobody. They spent over $1 billion with a B.
I don't understand on that, but when Boeing put that fence up, what a lot of people don't understand is it had a 15-second to 30-second delay. So what happened live, 30 seconds later, you would see on the screen.
Right.
Well, think about how far you can get in 30 seconds. Now, there was a group down, and Michael knows this, there was a group down on the border that put up with their own money essentially the same thing. Cost them about $5,000.
Yep,
It actually worked. It was real time, and they had people. They had people emailing in saying, "I will take this time period. I will watch it this time period, and this is the number to INS, and this is the number to Border Patrol, and we will call in anything that we see." I was a member of the Minutemen organization, the original Minutemen organization that Chris Simcox had started years and years ago.
Right.
I was the chairman of the Central Arizona part, which started from Casa Grande and went all the way through the northern part of the state. We were told, and we did real good work with Border Patrol, and we had a great relationship with immigration control as well, with ICE. There were times we were told, as we were entering the Avra Valley, which is a huge, at that time, a very huge trafficking point for methamphetamines and illegal aliens and stuff like that, we were stopped by Border Patrol and told we couldn't go in there because they couldn't guarantee our safety.
Well, you've seen those signs, that, and it was all over the Washington Times. Jerry Sieper, the investigative editor for the Washington Times, interviewed me numerous times. And one day he called me up. He said, what do you think of these signs that are up that warn people to stay away because they're likely to encounter, this is within our secure border, mind you, heavily armed smugglers moving at high rates of speed.
Yeah, when they say heavily armed smugglers,
I kid you
not.
No, I kid you not. And I said that I recommended that maybe the time has come to change the colors of Old Glory from red, white, and blue to a simple white flag, the flag of surrender.
Well,
Mike, I'm going to pick your brains, Mike, because I read an article, and this was before 9/11 happened. And
okay.
I know I was in a New York doctor's office, so it had to be prior to 2001.
Okay.
And it may have been either Newsweek or one of the news magazines, and they were talking about our porous borders, and they were giving the stats of the people coming across the borders. But that was the first time I heard the term other than Mexican. And then they broke down the statistics of how many were coming from Yemen, Pakistan. And
what we now call special interest countries because they're associated with terrorism.
And this was prior to 9/11.
Yes.
After 9/11 occurred, I could not find that article anywhere.
No, it went off the air. A lot of things went off the air. Do you realize, do you remember the stories where we had the National Guard down on the southern borders of Arizona?
Yes, and they got an award, and they were unarmed, and they got an award for backing up in the face of intruders that were heavily armed. Remember that?
The Mexicans came over the border.
They were not unarmed. And that was the funny part. They had rifles. They had bullets in their clips. They were not allowed to chamber around. And if they were encroached upon, they were required to retreat to a safe place.
Right.
They were encroached upon three times. We found out about it when the Arizona Red Star, or the Daily Star, excuse me, out of Tucson slipped and reported it. And we took it viral on the Internet. And so that story got out. We found out that it happened three times. As a matter of fact, we almost lost one of our soldiers because as they were retreating, he knelt down and stuck his knee into a nest of scorpions, and they had no epinephrine kits to do anything for the gentleman. Almost lost him. We brought up, I believe it was the Tennessee National Guard. Don't hold me to that. I may be wrong of the exact National Guard, but we brought up a group of these gentlemen, and they had Thanksgiving at my house down here in Levine. And we sat down and we talked about it. And they were not able to talk too much about it because they get themselves in trouble, but they were under strict orders not to do anything. The majority of the National Guard that went down to the southern border went down to do things like repair cars, do right. general maintenance, so that the, quote, Border Patrol people, who are very good people, would be free to go out and do their job. Well, the Border Patrol people, when you talk about people like Ramos and Compion, for example, here you've got Border Patrol agents who are doing their job, go after smugglers, a firefight ensues, and they end up, and the two border agents end up in jail because the evidence would not be allowed to be brought into court.
It got worse than that. When an agent is about to testify in court, and I'm trying to remember the name of the decision, but let me tell you how it works. Because I've certainly testified often enough. The U.S. attorney sits you down, and they want to know everything and anything in your background that is negative about your credibility. Not so that they can make certain that they protect themselves and keep the questions away from you, but so that the other side gets to know anything of that nature. So let's say, for argument's sake, and I've never been suspended, I've never been investigated for wrongdoing, so let me clear that up. But let's play a hypothetical game that one day, 15 years ago, I was suspended 2 days for taking a three-hour lunch. Not only would I have to report that to the U.S. attorney, but he would immediately report that to the defense attorney. Now, why am I telling you this? Because the smuggler that they had the altercation with had a prior arrest record. That information was never provided to the defense team that defended Ramos and Compion. Do you realize how insane that is?
Well, actually, it was given to the defense team, according to Ramos. Ramos, if you want to call him. I call him Ramos. I've talked to him about that, but that was not allowed to be brought into court.
The jury was not allowed to hear it. That was the bottom line.
So, Goldie, I got a question for you, Goldie. What's it like?
Yeah.
Obviously, you mentioned you're a Republican. The greatest of all greats, the president of all presidents, the Einstein of all Einsteins. What's it like when George W. Bush, the a-hole of the planet, calls you a vigilante for being a Minuteman and protecting our borders?
Damn funny. As a matter of fact, I just wrote an article the other day and getting ready to publish it. I knew Ronald Reagan before he was governor. And I played with his son, and I knew Patty Jr. I did not get a chance to know his other son, Michael. I wish I had, and I hope someday to spend some time with him. But I knew Ronnie well enough to the point that when Nancy's mother died and we were going to the receiving line, I remember my sister went into shock because I invited the President of the United States to come up to Lake Powell to go fishing.
Wow.
I felt that comfortable with it. So here I am on the border, and I'm thinking about Ronald Reagan and his famous speech in Germany. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Well, we've been promised a wall in Arizona, and it made a lot of sense to me. Mr. Bush, build us this wall. Well, people got angry because they thought I was insulting Ronald Reagan. Well, Ronald Reagan was there. Even though he granted the first form of amnesty, he at least was honest enough to come back and say that was one of the worst decisions I ever made in my life.
Well, I got to cut you off there on that one, because I'll tell you what bothered me. We never hired any more agents to enforce the law. They never provided training in document fraud, so that agents could figure out whether or not the documentation that was being shown was legitimate or not. I think it was a dodge to be able to have credible deniability, or plausible deniability. And that was the sense of most of my colleagues at the INS at the time, Don. I'm sorry to burst that bubble, but that's how we all felt about it.
Yeah, well, I want to add in on that one. At the time he did that, the amnesty, I remember we responded to a burglary in a Catholic church. And when we got to the church, to the rectory, what was broken into was the room in which they processed aliens to get them green cards. But the church wasn't authorized to process these documents and give these alien green cards. And we weren't allowed to report this to the INS, that this Catholic church was issuing illegal documents to illegal aliens.
Okay, let's clarify something, because this is something that gets people very upset, and there's one little problem between church and country, and this is it. Tell me, let's say the Catholic Church, can you tell me what the borders of the Catholic Church are?
It has none.
Okay, but can you tell me what the borders of the United States are supposed to be?
Now, they're supposed to be clearly defined between Canada
all
and
right.
Mexico and the two oceans.
So this is the dilemma that all churches face, that there is no such thing as an illegal alien because they have no borders. I'm not saying that's right, wrong, or indifferent. I'm just saying that's a reality.
Well, but here's the point, though. You know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
No, I understand
and,
that.
Well, but here's my point, though, Don. And, you know, I testified before the Indiana State Senate. And this was over their immigration bill. First it was SB 570, and then that didn't pass. We did get 590 enacted.
Right.
And we had members of the Catholic Church. And being Jewish, it's hard for me to argue with the church. It's easier for me to argue with a rabbi than a priest, just the way we're raised. But it was astonishing to me to be told by a member of the Catholic Church that we needed to respect the dignity of the undocumented. And I explained at that hearing, and they tried to cut me off, and Mike Delf, who was the state senator who proposed the legislation, made certain that I was able to speak at least as long as the people from the ACLU and even a high school student, graduate, who was allowed to speak for about 15, 20 minutes. And I said, you know, I have raided apartments, and I'm sure as a New York City police officer, you've seen stuff like this. You go into an apartment where you've got 20 adult men jammed into a two-bedroom apartment with one bathroom where it's so filthy that the stench stays in your nostrils for weeks.
Oh, yeah.
We turn on a light switch. We used to call it the moving wall. The insects
covering
the wall.
Oh, no, don't bring back those memories. Oh, God, that brings back bad memories.
Doesn't it? And, you know, when one of my buddies retired, I went to his party, and he came up to me, and I had worked with Bob for, gosh, at least a quarter of a century. He said, Mike, I'm going to miss working with you. I'm going to miss the other guys, but I will not miss the stench of poverty. And
no.
Everybody involved with illegal aliens, whether it's La Raza, Mecha, LULAC, the ACLU, or the Catholic Church, know that these people are living in abject squalor in the United States.
Well, and I think in a lot of cases they're living in a lot worse conditions. When you get into the holding houses and the halfway houses. And
I agree with you, but all I'm saying, everyone knows what reality is. And what was so remarkable was when I got done talking about it, after that hearing was completed, I was out in the hallway. They had allowed an illegal alien to testify. This was kind of funny in a twisted way. Some woman came running up to me, screaming at the top of her lungs, how dare I come to her state of Indiana from New York? I should stay in my own damn state, as she put it. I said, you know, you had an illegal alien testify. Didn't that bother you? And she didn't know what to say. She went running out of there. But what was so funny was, or not funny, but poignant perhaps, that illegal alien ran towards me, and I'm standing in the hallway thinking, you know, I'm on the wrong side of 60. I hope this guy doesn't want a fist fight. And it was him and his three buddies. He hugged me, and he had tears in his eyes. He told me that I was the first American that he had ever heard publicly talk about how terribly they're treated. He told me, Mr. Cutler, if you treated a dog the way we're treated, you'd go to jail. When you do it to us, nothing happens to you.
Okay, well, the point I was trying to get to at the end is to agree with you on what you're talking about, is that because the churches don't have a border, the color of illegal immigration is green. That's what it's all about.
Absolutely.
And we have problems today where we've got a horrible We've got a horrible housing industry here. Our commercial is really down. Our industrial is really down. It's starting to bottom out. And yet we have people now calling for, we need to bring the illegal aliens back in as undocumented workers because we need them to build homes. Well, you can't build a home for $27 a foot. And that's what the HUD homes, that's what the HUD homes are starting to be auctioned off at. That doesn't mean that's the ending price, but even if they sell off at $90 a foot, you can't build a home here in Arizona, a standard home, for less than $95 a foot. It just doesn't happen. So here we go again. We've got to have these people in here. We've got to have these people in here. And you know what? Let ATF take care of this issue. Let them check the passports and stuff. If I can go buy a gun in 10 minutes and they can do a thorough background check on me in 10 minutes and find out whether or not I'm a felon, I'm here legally, and I have a right to own a firearm, isn't that kind of the same thing that a person coming into this country has to be checked on to get a visa?
Well, it's actually supposed to be more involved than that. I'll tell you a quick funny story about that. I met Jim Sensenbrenner when I first started to take my show on the road, in a manner of speaking. And it was funny because Babe Buchanan, Pat Buchanan's sister, had said to me that I was becoming a national figure. I had been in Arizona, and this was long before I met you, Don. And it was a strange experience because I'd never had this happen before. I walked into a big room. There must have been a few hundred people in the room. Now, here I am 2,000 miles from home. And people coming up to me saying, how are you, Mr. Cutler? Great to meet you. And it didn't compute. I'm in Arizona. I'm a New Yorker. How do they all know me? Well, I was on TV. I mean, I knew how they knew me, but it was startling. And Babe Buchanan said to me, this is what being a national figure will do. It will get to a point where you will not be able to walk into an airport terminal without people waving at you, which has happened.
Now, or throwing eggs at you.
Or throwing eggs at me, exactly, or worse, hand grenades. But what then happened was I met Jim Sensenbrenner when he chaired the House Judiciary Committee.
Right.
And he was supporting George W.'s guest worker program. And it was funny because I had written the commentary that Lou Dobbs had borrowed on the air, which is how we killed the guest worker program, because I added one word to guest worker. I called it the guest worker amnesty program, and that was the term that Lou Dobbs had adopted. So everybody within about a week had gotten to the point of referring to it as the guest worker amnesty program.
Right.
And I met Jim Sensenbrenner. He came up to me. I was there to do a speaking engagement with what is now a defunct website, but it was the counterterrorism blog. And he said to me, Mr. Cutler, it's great to meet you. And I said to him, Mr. Chairman, you know, and by the way, I knew he was in campaign mode. And having run for office, you know how that works. You want to be pleasant with the people around you. Hi, how are you? Great to see you. No matter what foolishness they tell you, you're not going to have an argument with the guy and tell him he's an idiot. You just say, wow, that's interesting. I'll give it thought. You keep on moving. And they get to that point where that's all they want to do. Great to hear that. Oh, that's interesting. Wow, it's wonderful. And just keep on moving. Because they're in that mode when they're in Washington. They're in the fishbowl. And it's a conditioned response. Just like a cop in the alleyway, conditioned response is to pull out the gun. Conditioned response for the politician is to just engage in mindless chatter with people. And, and it's understandable. So I needed to break that rhythm of that banter that he was having with everybody. And he's got his little entourage of five or six people following behind him. And, and Sensenbrenner came up to me, and I said to him, you know, you made a statement a couple of weeks ago, and I haven't had a good night's sleep since. And he said to me, are we talking about national security? And I looked him in the eye, and I said, well, I sure as hell wouldn't be discussing my sex life, would you? Would I now?
That would keep
and
me
let
up
me tell you, he and everybody in the room just broke up laughing, which accomplished my goal of get him to listen to what I was saying. And I said, look, if I can't sleep at night, sure as hell I don't want you sleeping at night. I said, you said you wanted a guest worker program, and I'd love 30 minutes with you. He said, well, we'd have to talk to my scheduler. We'd have to talk to – I said, all right, can you give me 30 seconds? He said, I'll give you a minute. What do you want to tell me? I said, Mr. Chairman, how in the world would you prevent a terrorist from getting an official identity document in a false name that he or she could then use to embed himself in a community and then prepare to attack America again and kill many more of our fellow citizens?
Right.
He looked at me and said, interesting point. I will give it thought. And I thought, oh, he's back in that mode again. And he started to walk away. He got about 20 feet from me. Folks, I wish I had a video of this because it was hilarious. He stopped short, and the five or so people that were trailing behind him crashed into his rear end like a highway pileup. It was absolutely hilarious. And I mean, you got a picture of Jim Sensenbrenner. The guy is like a building with feet. And he comes back.
I have a question about the Hiroshima plan.
I'm sorry?
Have you, Michael, have you talked at all about the Hiroshima plan in George Bush, George Jr.'s first term?
No, I'm not familiar with that. I just wanted to finish making my point. Just give me 30 seconds and I'll wrap this. But the point that I'm making, he came back and said, now take all the time you need. What is it you're trying to tell me? Because you do have my attention.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, just to back up what you're saying, Mike, is this is a statistic from 2010. In April, May, and June, for every two Americans that lost a job, three native-born workers got a job.
I'll get to that in a moment because there's a point that needs to be made there also. But here was what I said to Sensenbrenner. I said, let me give you a hypothetical because maybe this will sink in the best way I know how. Supposing, and this is obviously long before Bin Laden was taken out, supposing we don't have fingerprints for Bin Laden on file. Supposing Bin Laden changed his appearance, walked into an immigration office, and said his name was Donald Duck. They would run his fingerprints, they'd come back no hit. They run Donald Duck, it comes back no hit because it's a fake name. Within 24 hours, Mr. Chairman, as I said to Mr. Sensenbrenner at the time, this program that you're supporting would provide Bin Laden himself and his henchmen with official identity documents and false names that would immediately provide them with Social Security cards, driver's licenses, library cards, which means access to the Internet without them being able to track it back to them, credit cards. They would be able to get a job that, if it didn't have national security implications, would have critical infrastructure implications. They could get on airplanes and walk into every government and state and corporate office building in America with this document that you want to give them.
And I have one problem. Is I think
he killed that program within a week.
Okay, Michael, that was a good point. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Mike, what does that mean when you say a bounce back, a no hit? I've heard that numerous times on TV shows where they say the cops ran a plate and it bounced back a no hit.
No record of wants, warrants, or criminal history.
Okay, so there's no
clean. It comes up clean.
Okay, yeah. I got a quick question for you, Goldie. Had you been elected? Obviously, Arizona is in the news a lot regarding immigration. Had you been elected the governor, what would you have done to basically? Obviously, Jan Brewer did something. This went to court. What would you have done differently? And what would be taking place right now in Arizona had you been elected the governor?
We had what was called GRIP, the Goldwater Reform Immigration Pact. What we would have done is taken the state's National Guard, put it down on the border. Russell Pierce was running a law that ultimately we helped pass that took the I-9 and made it electronic so that every employer had to verify that the people that they were hiring were in fact legal. I ran an initiative, he ran a bill. They were both written by the same person. My initiative was a one strike and you're out. His was two strikes and you're out. The way the law was written is that you cannot supersede federal law. We cannot arrest, we cannot do anything of that nature, but what we can do is we can take away licenses that the state gives. So if it's a business license, and it's a Hilton Hotel, and they're hiring illegal aliens. The first time you go in, you arrest the illegal aliens. You find the company. The second time you walk in, you can pull their business license and say goodbye. You're out of Arizona. So we did get that law passed. That was part of the deal. Mine was one strike and you're out, and the reason we did that is we played the Wizard of Oz. Everybody was so concerned about me that they forgot to look at Russell. They finally passed Russell's law, and then we had a bunch of Republicans, old-time Republicans that got together that tried to put another law on the book. They said it was even stronger than Russell's law. And had that law passed, it would have replaced Russell's law. One small problem. It was an illegal law. It was a constitutional amendment that carried two issues. And under state law, you can only have one issue on a constitutional amendment. So we battled that law. And I remember debating Mrs. Pacheco and Andrew Pacheco and a bunch of people on this law, and we beat it. They had millions of dollars. We had millions of people. And so everybody got on the phone. We closed down the White House. We closed down our senators and our representatives' offices. As a matter of fact, one of our senators, who I will not spell out, actually put up a third private line, and we found out the telephone number and shut that down. And here's the deal. In 2000, when I ran for governor in 2006, and I'm not trying to scream spilt milk because I really wasn't supposed to run. Another gentleman, Frank Riggs, is supposed to run, and at the last minute he found out he didn't qualify. I was supposed to run his campaign. They asked me to run, and I said, look, guys, if I run, here's who I'm running against. I'm running against the state Republican Party. I'm running against the state Arizona delegation. I'm running against the national Republican Party, the president of the United States. And then if I get through the primary, I get to run against Janet Napolitano. And everybody looked at me and said, you're nuts. Well, I did end up having three or four other candidates I had to run against. I came in second. The gentleman that I lost to was supported by the federal delegation. When we went and talked to his campaign manager, who was Nathan Sproul, I said, Nathan, he can't win in the general. He's a great guy, but he's too far right. It just won't work. And Nathan looked at us straight in the face and said, we don't care about the general. We just don't want you to win.
Wow.
So I don't win in the primary. Okay, that's life. Politics is yesterday. Life is today. The person who ran in the general had lost by the greatest landslide in the state of history, say history of Arizona. He didn't even carry the Republican Party. He lost by about 32%. That was designed. So this is now 2006. We're coming up in November 2006. Guess what pops up in January of 2007? The illegal immigration bill.
Surprise, surprise.
And one of our United States senators was pushing that bill because the other United States senator was running for president. And we met with the senator and said, asked him ahead of time, is there amnesty in this? We had 25 people in the room. I mean, it was almost comical because I was trying to sit next to him and we were jumping around the table. This doesn't make me a great person. It makes me an idiot for trying to do this, but I get strange sometimes. He told us over and over again that there was no amnesty attached to this bill. We walked out of that meeting, the head of the state party, we all looked at each other and knew exactly what we heard. We knew exactly it wasn't accurate. We knew exactly we were in trouble. And the war was on. The game was on. We went to all the groups. We went to, Amnesty International. We went to Russell Pierce. We went to Pakenham Coalition. We went to the Minutemen. We went to every group we could get our hands on and said, please, we've got to stop this. Get this out. Get this out to the news. Get this out of the state. And the people of the United States stood up and stopped it. But how long does it take to write a bill?
But here's the problem, though, Don. I don't want to cut you off, but here's the problem that we're looking at. And Ann made a really great point about people being out of work. Do you remember the week before the election? And they're doing it again. They were talking about how many jobs were created. Oh, they created 180,000 new jobs, and unemployment still went to 7.9%. And if you believe 7.9, then you believe that Bernie Madoff was on the level.
Yeah.
But here's the deal. We are admitting into the United States legally about 150,000 foreign workers per month.
Right.
We are giving out about over 1.1 million green cards. Now, yes, some of them are kids, but God willing, they will grow up. They will be workers. So you have the kids now that are getting older who were admitted 10 years ago who are joining the labor force. So the way I look at it, you got close to 100,000 green cards per month. You've got the exchange visitor program. 2011, we admitted 447,000 foreign students. They almost always get practical training, which means a job. We have the H-1Bs. You've got the agricultural workers. And we don't police the system. So no matter how many foreign workers you bring in to work on farms, because you keep hearing, we need more farm workers, right? Guess what?
Right.
We don't police the system. Many of them do not show up on the farm, and nobody seems to care. Well, we should care, because when I started to work with the New York City Police Department, this was long before we had formal task force arrangements, in the late 70s, I had a desk at the 7-1 precinct in Brooklyn, which is a tough neighborhood. Ann's familiar with it. It's on Empire Boulevard, heavy Caribbean area. We had a ton of agricultural workers from Jamaica and the Caribbean who were supposed to work in the apple orchards, supposed to work in the orange groves of Florida. They decided to deal with a different cash crop, primarily marijuana, then it became cocaine, and the level of violence that they perpetrated to support their drug trade was mind-numbing. We were responding to shootings. I was working with the cops. Almost every day there were shootings. Now, these were people that were admitted to work on farms. They didn't go to the farm, okay?
No.
And we're doing the same thing now, but worse. So we keep on bringing people into America to do jobs. No one tracks them. There are 10,000 schools authorized to bring in foreign students. No one's tracking them. I don't know if you folks remember. Yeah, but here's the deal. Do you remember when Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, two of the dead terrorists, got authorization to attend flight school 6 months after 9/11?
Yeah.
Sheila Jackson Lee called me to testify at that congressional hearing. And if you go to michaelcutler.net or talkborder.com or capsweb.org, you can actually see a video of that hearing to this day. It's up there on C-SPAN. So now the GAO most recently, a couple months ago, said that 38% of the flight schools still have not filed the requisite paperwork with the FAA 11 years plus after 9/11.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And yet, when I go in to get my paperwork done to fly,
they put you through hell.
Yeah, I mean, you think I'm a terrorist
we're strip searching 85-year-old women at airports, and we're getting dosed with radiation, and they still don't know if those machines are safe. But meanwhile, when thousands of illegals run the border, we have no idea who they are or why they're here. We're told, oh, we have to put them on a pathway to citizenship. What this administration has done, just by talking about amnesty, they have fired the starter's pistol, and for millions of aspiring illegal aliens across the planet, the finish line is the border of the United States of America.
So, Mike, what you are saying basically is, and I'm kind of exaggerating here, but just say yes or no. Basically, whatever crime you commit wherever, if you can basically get here, there's a chance under the Obama administration policies as such that regardless of whatever crimes you've committed elsewhere, that you could have a clean slate here in America.
Yeah,
that's
Mike,
exactly
before
right.
Before
and let me tell you how bad it is, and I confronted Mike Chertoff about this. When an alien naturalizes, they get to take any name they want. But when they get a U.S. passport, the passport only reflects their new name. They put themselves in their own witness protection program. I got a call from an inspector at a major port of entry. He had a guy come in with a U.S. passport issued in Lebanon. The guy did not look like maybe the son of American citizens, but perhaps he naturalized. So he had an Anglo-sounding name, and he said to the guy, what was your name before you naturalized? when he ran that name, which was an Arabic name, it turned out that he was a wanted international terrorist who for 4 years traveled extensively, looking at all the stamps in the passport, traveled extensively throughout Europe, the Middle East, and Latin America under an assumed identity which endangered our allies and gave this guy access to airplanes here in the United States. And, in fact, the JTTF rushed down there and took him into custody, and I said to Chertoff, why in the world aren't we adding second names onto those passports so we properly identify these people? And he said, we're working on it. I said, you know, it took 44 months to win the Second World War. We had to build fleets of airplanes and ships and battle systems and atom bombs. 44 months. Here it is almost 20 years after the attacks of 93. At this point, almost a decade, because this is a 2009, almost a decade since 9/11. And you're working on it? I said, what quantum leap in technology, what Manhattan Project are we breathlessly awaiting so that we can add a second name on a U.S. passport? And he said to me, you don't understand the politics of this.
Of course. None of us understand.
Mike,
we're all idiots.
Mike, I want to add a point. You're talking about criminals coming into the country. We've got a problem with the criminals in the country, because if you've got an illegal alien that has committed a crime here and has been convicted and sent to jail – when they're released from jail, if their home country does not want them back, if it's Lebanon or Afghanistan or whatever it is, if they say no, that guy is forced to stay – not forced. We are forced to accept him here. Free of charge.
Yes.
He's out on his own, free to commit another crime, and we cannot support
him. And in some cases, it's because their countries won't take him. In other cases, because we don't have the resources. I work with Senator Al D'Amato to do two things or three things. Prioritize criminal aliens over non-criminal. That doesn't mean ignore the non-criminal, as this administration is doing. I also convinced them to enact a new law that made reentry after deportation for criminal aliens a separate crime with a 20-year penalty rather than the 2-year crime that it is for non-criminals. The consequence of that is that half the federal prosecutions around the country today are prosecutions for immigration violations, and that they would hold deportation hearings inside the prisons. The problem is we have never fully funded these programs. So we keep on releasing people onto the street. Many of them are, as you point out, rightfully so, because their country won't take them back. But even where we could get them sent back, we just don't have the resources dedicated to this. Chertoff's argument, when I mentioned it to him, well, we don't have the money. I said, we don't have the money to keep these people here. It would be a net saving to get rid of the criminals and to make certain that there's integrity to the program. Fraud runs rampantly throughout the immigration benefits program right now. If we had to suddenly process 11 million, 20 million, 30 million applications, no face-to-face interviews, and within 5 years when they become citizens, they could then bring all their extended families here, America will be changed irrevocably. National security will no longer be possible for the United States of America. We will no longer know who's here. The point I made yesterday on Neil Cavuto and the point I'm going to make here and the point that I've made in congressional hearings, we know that there are Iranian shock troops arriving right now in Latin America, right into Venezuela. There is no way that we can defend ourselves against these folks and the terrorists working or training in the tri-border region of Brazil without securing our borders, without having an effective interior enforcement program. New York City has between 35,000 and 40,000 cops, depending on what year, what the attrition rate is. We have 7,000 ICE agents. Fewer than half of them are actually doing immigration law enforcement. Put it shortly, there's about 10% as many ICE agents enforcing immigration laws for the entire United States of America as we have police officers to secure the city of New York.
All right, gentlemen, we're inside our last 2 minutes. This whole entire show has flown, absolutely flown. And I do have to apologize for the problem I had with my mic earlier. I'm going to be working with BTR after we get off the air to see if we can clear it up. But, Mike Cutler, it has been a pleasure, and you know I do want you back on the show. And, Goldie, you too.
We got to get you both on.
Absolutely. And Don, I got to get to see you live in a person. Either you got to come to the Big Apple or I'll head back to Arizona. It's always a pleasure to speak to Don. Folks, it's a pleasure being on your program, and it was wonderful meeting you, and I'm happy to do your program. I'll have to get you on my show, the Michael Cutler Hour, Friday nights at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. But please go to my website, michaelcutler.net, talkborder.com, capsweb.org.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to remind everyone we will be back again on Friday, and our guest on Friday is author Brett Bratton. He's got Homeland Insecurity. So we're going to be following up on this subject with Brett Bratton. And, Mike, you're welcome to join us in Goldie on Friday, same time, same bat time, same bat station.
If I'm able to, I certainly will. I'm happy to do it. You know, you're doing an incredible service for America because the mainstream media is very reluctant, if they're willing at all, to cover this issue. And I don't think there's anything more important than these issues right now.
Annie is never afraid to challenge anyone. Just ask Michelle Bachmann how long she lasted on her interview. She hung up on Annie.
All right. Well, I want to have everyone to have a very healthy and happy week, and we'll see you back here on Friday at 2 p.m. So good night, and God bless. Until then.
God bless you, and God bless America.
You betcha. Be well, everybody.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American.
Stand up, let's make it loud, American.